Hi, this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 84 of Art for Your Ear. This episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Now, today's artist has been featured on my blog a lot, but you guessed it, we've never actually spoken in person. Paper cutting, metal pieces, installations, birds, maps, flowers. Yep, I am talking to London-based artist Claire Brewster. I need to understand how she cuts all of the perfect things that she cuts. Ready? Calling London. It's so nice to do this.
It's amazing because it's like I listen to the podcast and it's like you hear your voice and it's so familiar, but it's like, oh, I'm actually talking to her now.
I know. Oh, I love it. Well, and it's so funny because, I mean, I say this at the beginning of so many things that I feel like I've known you for so long, but we've never talked. So it's just so, I'm so happy that we're doing this finally.
Yes. I think the internet's weird like that though, isn't it? Because it's like social media and you almost feel like you know people and then you think, oh, but actually, I've never met them and I've never spoken to them.
I know. It is weird. I love it though, because it just connects, like, you know, that you're in the UK, I'm in Western Canada, but, you know, we still kind of know each other. I love that.
Well, yeah, exactly. And yeah, before the internet, this would never be happening, would it?
No, so it wouldn't. And so now I get to ask you all my stuff. I should have looked. Do you know what year I first wrote about you?
I don't actually. I was meaning to look as well. It was a long time ago though.
It was like it was probably in my first or second year. Like it was probably I started in 2009. So I think I must have written about you in the very first year. I'll have to go back and look and I'll check out. I'll put it in the post for research sake.
Yeah. No. It would be good to know because it feels like a long time ago.
It does. Well, let's speaking of a long time ago. Amazing segue. Let's talk about little Claire. What were you like as a kid? Were you cutting out perfect birds then?
I wasn't cutting out perfect birds, but I did used to cut out things because we used to do a lot of scrapbooking. I have very fond memories, and I actually still have one of my scrapbooks when I was a kid. Of kind of, you know, sitting around the kitchen table cutting out pictures.
Really?
And sticking them. I was quite obsessed by saucepans and kittens. Yeah, they were quite big. Horses, saucepans, kittens. Yeah, they were kind of, you know.
Well, those interest. Are all fantastic things. Why would you not cut them out?
And yeah, I have to dig out. There's a page I always mean to post on social media, I think, where there's just like cut out loads of saucepans out of a catalogue.
Why?
I have no idea. Art was always my thing, I guess, when I was a kid. I mean, I was always drawing, painting. I had a very wonderful grandmother who was quite an enabler because she bought me my first set of watercolours, like proper tubes, when I was, I don't know, must have been sort of 9 or 10 maybe. And then she also bought me a box of proper pastels when I was a bit older, but yeah, you know, they were always like the best presents.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that kind of stuff because it makes kids feel like they're real artists.
I think buying proper materials, I mean, you know, obviously you don't need to buy the most expensive, but yeah, like proper tubes of paint is like, it's like such a step up from using sort of cheap watercolor pans or something.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like it feels like really, yeah, like someone's taking you seriously.
Yeah. There was an artist that I met, and he told this great story. I heard him speak at Emily Carr University in Vancouver, and he was saying that when he was 9, this is in like 1954 or something, he lived in a really teeny tiny town and they were moving to Vancouver, I think. And so his teacher, so that would have been probably like third or fourth grade, I guess. He was moving and his teacher had recognized what a great artist he was, but he just never really thought much of it, you know. And so the going away gift that the class got him was a set of real oil paints, like for grown-ups.
Wow.
And he said it was that moment, you know, he was 9. He said it was that moment that he thought, oh, like I could be an artist when I grow up.
Yeah.
And I just love that story so much because it's so important. Like, you know, that teacher was probably just giving him this nice gift, but like, he's like one of Canada's foremost artists. And you know, wow. It started because this teacher believed in him and gave him this set of paints.
Yeah, it's kind of life-changing at that age.
Yeah.
I didn't really know being an artist was a thing, you know, and back then it wasn't, you know, I guess because we didn't have the internet, you only read about artists in books.
Yeah.
And newspapers, it wasn't like you kind of knew any, I didn't know anyone, my parents didn't know anyone, you know, I grew up in a kind of semi-rural county in England, it wasn't like art wasn't a thing that you did.
Yeah.
You know, you went to look at paintings in museums and, you know, in books, but I don't know if I ever really thought that's what I'd be.
Was your grandmother an artist, or did she just recognize it in you?
She was a big knitter, actually. She used to knit. She wasn't an artist. I mean, you know, I guess it was. There was a lot of creativity around, but no one was specifically an artist in right. that kind of sense. I guess those sort of options probably weren't really available.
Right.
You know, I guess it just wasn't something that. Anyone would really think of, she probably would have thought of doing.
Exactly. I interviewed my mom before Christmas because my mom's an artist and asked her exactly that, like, because she said the same thing. I didn't know anybody that was an artist. It seemed so out of reach. And it's like, well, would you have gone, you know, to art school if it had been an option? She wasn't entirely sure. Anyway.
That was such a good interview.
It was so, I felt really like kind of a bad daughter. I was like, how do I not know all this stuff? But
she's your mom and you don't ask your mom. I was in the email I sent you. I was like, okay, I think I need to interview my mom.
I know. I'm so happy that I did it. And my sister was like, that was amazing. And my brother too. Like everyone in our family loved it because she never talks about that stuff, you know? And she's so talented. She just never really ever talked about it. And so it was very cool to talk to her like Judy instead of my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so did you go to art school?
I did, yes. Yeah.
From the jump? Like, did you go right out of high school?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, I went to, I think they still do here. I'm not sure, but I did an art foundation. And then I, in the nearest kind of place that I could do it, I still lived at home for an extra year. And then I went off and left and came to London to go to college.
And but, so what did your family think when you did that?
I don't know. I've never really asked my parents.
There's the first interview question.
It's one of those things that I think there was never any doubt that that's what I was going to do. I mean, once I kind of reached that point of, I guess, you know, being sort of 15, 16, I mean, I wasn't very good at school and I didn't pass many of my exams. And I basically pushed myself into a corner that the only thing I could do would be to go to art school, which was the only thing I wanted to do. So, you know, I was probably, you know, way ahead of the game of everyone else. But
perfect plan executed brilliantly.
Yeah. So, I guess it was like the only sort of thing. I guess the compromise that I ended up doing was that I did a degree in constructed textiles, which is knitting, weaving and tapestry weaving. I kind of thought that I was going to be like a textile designer, but then I realized I really wasn't really interested in it. I love textiles, but I don't really want to design kind of in a commercial sense, which I discovered on my degree. So I ended up specializing in tapestry weaving because it was like the most fine art option that was available, because it was basically doing fine art, but you just made a picture and then made a tapestry of it.
Right. Do you still do those ever?
No, I haven't touched a tapestry loom since I think I've made the last one and kind of left, graduated, and that was it on the tapestry weaving front.
So what did you do when you graduated? Like, did you play at all with paper in school or no, you were just...
I've always worked with paper, and the tapestries that I made, because you make like a cartoon, which is basically you make a picture and then you make a tapestry of it. Mm. We're always collages, kind of mixed media paintings. I used a lot of text in the works and sort of stuff that I'd kind of collected and found. I was very heavily influenced by Robert Rauschenberg at that sort of point.
Me too.
So that kind of idea of kind of, you know, collecting stuff off the street and just random objects. So they were that was the work that I was making, and that was what I really wanted to make. The tapestries I'd kind of had to make to get my degree. They were like a sign. They were kind of quite good. I mean, they were small. You know, in the end, they came out really well, and you know, everyone thought they were okay. So that was, you know, it wasn't really a thing that I wanted to spend my life doing because they take forever. And
yeah, you were kind of done after the collage, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The collage was kind of like the thing. And I kind of, yeah, I guess when I graduated, I sort of faffed around doing those, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I ended up doing a TEFL course, teaching English as a foreign language, and went and lived in Spain for a year. Oh. And then Romania for another year.
Where in it for the other year?
Romania.
Oh, wow. Wow. And so were you making art during that time, or were you just sort of traveling and teaching? And
I wasn't really making art, no. I mean, I occasionally did sort of sketches and stuff, but I stopped making art for quite a few years, I guess. I think it's difficult when you graduate. I don't know. There's so much kind of pressure. And I've had a few interns, and it's like sort of, you know, talking about what they're going to do when you graduate. And I'm just like, just do something else for a while, maybe. If you don't, you know, just take some time out. You don't have to make a decision straight away. It's quite difficult. And, you know, when I graduated, it was 1990, so there was quite a big recession happening here. So there was jobs or stuff really happening. So it just seemed like a good idea to go away and just sort of do something else for a while.
Yeah, that's actually brilliant. Because, you know, I graduated from university when I, like, what, when you're like 21 or something.
Yeah.
You're so young.
Well,
but
exactly.
It's the oldest you've ever been. You're now like a college graduate, and you're like, oh, I guess I'm supposed to be a grown up. So I should have a job and I should have all these things. But it's like, it's so hard. And unless you've trained in something really specific where you can graduate and get a job, and fine art is not of that way.
No.
It's tricky. And so, yeah, I think that's really good advice to just go. Like, I think the teaching thing was great, traveling, like just live a little bit, you know?
Yeah, because I think, you know, you need to find out a bit more about yourself and what you want. And I mean, it took me a long time to really figure out what I was wanting to do. And I mean, it took me a long time after that. But, you know, I just think, there's so much pressure to do this and do that. And, you know, you can change your mind so many times. We're all going to be working longer and longer now. So why not do a few different jobs if you want to, or do your art on the side for a bit and do something else, and then do, you know, I think there's many options. I think it's, you know, you don't have to, it's never binary, but yeah. It always feels like that. I think when you're 20, in your 20s, everything feels very binary.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's the one blessing of age, that things don't, you realize that nothing's really binary.
Yeah, I know. Oh, it was so funny when I got my very first job at, I went to university for fine art, and then I took a year off and traveled around Europe, and then worked odd jobs and stuff, and then went to design school, which then I graduated and like got an immediate job because it was, you know, like technical, right? And I got a job at IBM, and my dad was thrilled. He's like, well, that's great. He's like, they have a great like pension, and they have a great retirement package. I was like, what? I was 23, and I was like, I am not going to work here until I'm 65. And he was like, why not?
Like, not the world these days.
Yeah, and I don't know how many times I've changed jobs since then, you know.
So, but even people that go and work for IBM now won't work there till they're 60. I mean, you know,
yeah.
It's just not how it works. People move around, you know.
Yeah. Students that are listening, take some pressure off of yourself and know that you can change and you can evolve and you can move around. That's what Claire and I are passing on in our wisdom.
Exactly. And just don't take it all so seriously. I think I just took everything way too seriously.
Yeah, that's another problem with your early 20s.
Yeah, way too intense, and kind of like, if you don't do it now, then, you know, it's never going to happen.
Exactly.
Well, maybe it'll happen later. You know, the world is littered with artists. I mean, there's that Cuban American artist woman, isn't there, that Herrera is, who's got an exhibition at the Whitney at the minute that didn't sell her first painting until she was 89.
Yes, I know. I love those stories. I love those stories.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want that to happen, but
I know.
But you know, you just got to keep going, and yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I know. With every birthday, I always think, I wonder what I'll do in this. You know, I wonder what 41 will hold, or you know, because who knows?
Yeah,
you just have to be open to it. Okay, so you're teaching, you're traveling around. You don't know what you're going to do. You're taking it all too seriously. So you come home, and then what?
And then I kind of I guess I had to get a job and do well, make some money. Money was I guess to live in London, one always needs money. So I ended up doing like a sort of secretarial course, and learned how to use a computer, doing kind of word processing, and ended up doing kind of office managing jobs. Which I moved around, your dad will be shocked to know, very frequently. Never stayed for the pension package. I worked in all mainly kind of arts places. I worked in the university for a while and the film organization, and then latterly in some three different architects' practices, kind of running their offices. And it'll be 4 years in March since I gave that up.
That's it?
Yep.
Wow.
I mean, I was working part-time. The last job I was doing 3 days a week. I was there for nearly 5 years.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Okay. So when did you start making the art that you're making now? While you were working then, obviously.
Yes. Yeah. I guess I started making art again when I sort of came back from traveling and kind of... Because I guess it was like I'd had a break, and then there was always sort of something missing, but it was kind of, I could have found it difficult to know. I couldn't really figure out what it was, and then I realized it was probably the art that was missing. And I started dating a guy, he was a musician, and he kind of encouraged me to start making art again. And yeah, I was kind of doing it in the evenings and weekends. And we were together for about 10 years, I think. And then I guess, so in that time we kind of moved a lot and we ended up buying a house together. And then I had a kind of proper studio in the house. And so I was kind of making, that's when I first started making the paper cards, which I think was about 2002 when I first did the very first ones.
Wow. And what made you do that very first one?
I can't really tell you.
Yeah.
One of those just moments of, I was making a lot of paint, these sort of painting collages where I was painting things onto maps, and I'd been painting these, you have mentioned the collages that are on my website were all made from sort of pre-2002-ish, and I was doing all these paintings, and I was painting on the maps, and then I thought, well, maybe I could cut the, I was painting all these wallpaper patterns, and so maybe I could cut the pattern out, and I kind of did, but then I didn't really know what to do with it, and then I did the kind of professional practice for kind of artist evening class, and I met an artist, Nick Ramage, and he makes these amazing kind of machines that are sort of pointless, as in there was one that like unplugged itself and things like that. They're very funny and very good. And I guess we kind of clicked, and we decided to do an exhibition together. He used to have this amazing studio. It was like, you know, just full of stuff. He moved out of London a few years ago, but I was always loved going to his studio, you know, and it's just like, because he could make things, like mechanical things, which yeah. I just have no zero skill at. So we decided to do this exhibition together, and I'd done a bunch of paintings and collages, and then I decided to make some paper cuts, and these were full pages from an atlas that I cut a pattern out of. And I think that exhibition was in 2003, and I remember that Christmas I was up at my brother's house. They all went out to a party, and I was just sitting in his house cutting out maps.
And the obsession begins.
Exactly. Because it was like the exhibition was in January something or other, you know, and it's just like trying to get everything finished. So I was kind of took somehow took all this, took the stuff up on the train to
Oh my gosh.
Scotland. So, and yeah, they went out to show, you don't want to come. No, I'm just going to stay and do this.
Oh my gosh. And was that why was it Matt? Why Atlas Pages?
I think it's because I'd been doing all this work where I'd been cutting using mats, and I'd got these really beautiful, I think they're called the Oxford Advanced Atlas, and I just really loved the colors and the shapes on them. And I guess it was sort of, it was, yeah, I it's really hard to say sometimes, because you just kind of grab some things that are around that you know, and then it's only afterwards that you kind of start looking and wondering what was that all about. And as much as I just love that kind of paper, ephemera printed matter kind of things, and the old maps, there's such a beauty in them. And then they're always really fascinating because, you know, Great Britain has quite a history in terms of being an empire and, you know, all these things. And you're kind of looking at old maps and you kind of see, you know, the changing world. And I just find that endlessly fascinating, you know, the bits of a pink here and then they're not pink there. And then you've also got the USSR and how that changes, and Africa, you know, everywhere changes all the time.
Yeah, all
And
the
that's just
borders and everything. But the colors of those old maps are so beautiful too.
exactly. And the quality of the paper, and you know, they're really like high quality lithographs compared to, you know, the printed material really we get now. It's quite, they're just, you know, particularly from the kind of, it's mostly early 20th century, I'd say, are the one, the sort of, you know, up to about the 1940s, I think, are some of the nicest, you know, sort of 1900 up to 1940s, I think, some of the nicest maps. I think the 20s and 30s in particular, the colours that they used then were just so beautiful.
And it must be slightly thicker paper too than they use now, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like really nice paper quality and just the print quality, and just as a sort of a tone to the colours, it's just really beautiful. They're sort of vibrant, but not gaudy. They're kind of just that really beautiful, strong colours, but just some subtlety to it.
Yeah, they're almost
So
like
yeah.
vibrant pastel colors or something.
Yeah,
You know,
they
like,
are kind of, yeah, I know. Whereas sometimes, like, I mean, I don't, how often does one look at a map now? I don't very often have physical thing,
Google
but you know,
Maps.
yeah, exactly. But the colours are very strong, but in a, yeah, without any subtlety. I think that's, yeah.
Primary colors on Google Maps. And so have you always used X-Acto blades?
I don't actually use X-Acto blades. I use it's a Japanese company called Olfa, OLFA, because I find it, because the way I make the work, so when I first started, I used to do this insane thing that I used to trace the pattern or the bird onto the map and then realize I can actually see the lines because there's lines on the
Oh,
map. So then I thought, oh my God, I could stick the tracing paper on the back. Oh, so I make a template, and the problem I find with X-Acto blades is they skid on the and you end up breaking the nib off the tip. So the Olfa blades are, they're shorter, they're not quite as pointy,
okay.
and they also do really nice knife that has this big thick rubber bit around where your finger goes. So it's a bit more comfortable to use, I
Oh,
find.
that's good to know.
Yeah.
And were you always pretty good at, was it all your saucepans and kittens that got you prepared? Like, were you always pretty good at cutting out?
I've got a lot better, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, the source of the kittens were not particularly neat, I don't think. But I used to, when I first started doing collages, I used to use like a big Stanley knife type blade, which is
Oh
quite
my
hopeless,
gosh.
really. Exactly. And then I did use an X-Acto for a while, which the X-Acto were fine if you're cutting just the paper, but the minute you put tracing paper, because the tracing paper is kind of slippy, it just doesn't work. So I guess I kind of have got better and better as the years have gone by.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose now, you know, I can do it quite quickly. I was probably a lot slower than I it went, you know, but now it's quite quick, so.
Do you ever, because some of them are so intricate, like those flowers that you did, like the
Yes.
peony looking, or not peonies,
Oh, yeah.
like the hydrangea type looking
Oh,
flowers.
yeah.
So Can you get really far into that and really mess it up?
Not really, no, because you can usually fix it. I mean, you know, I have various archival paper tapes that I can stick on the back, and you'd never know that they. Oh, the only thing that really wrecks it would be if it got water on it.
Mm.
I mean, there's sometimes some maps, and I mostly don't really use them now. If the paper's very brittle, like if it's really dry, then they tend to rip. And actually, the pinning bit can be the bit where the most damage happens, because there's quite a lot of pressure being put on the paper at that point.
Oh, when you actually are finished and you exhibit it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so when they're actually pinned into the foam board so that they can be sort of raised up, so you get the three-dimensional quality, because I'm trying to get tension into the paper, but obviously not too much.
So yeah. You
rip it enough that it's, that it's flat. So if the map, sometimes the map can be very dry, you know, because it's just old paper, and that at that point they can rip quite badly. And
that would be heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that can be. I mean, some, you know, you end up having to stick, you know, loads of tape on, and it just gets a bit tedious at that point.
A tape sculpture. You can just say it's a tape sculpture.
Yes.
Yes. It's all in the sales. Well, that actually brings up a good point. I love, and do you consider this when you do it, the shadows that they make?
I mean, I don't really consider them when I'm actually making it. No, I don't. I mean, when I first started making them, I didn't even think about the shadows, to be honest. It just kind of was that, you know, it just sort of happened. I started pinning them. And
yeah, because you could have put them flat on something, but because they're sort of raised off, you do get that shadow.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of just a happy accident that I was just sort of messing around with the second sort of batch of things that I made were individual flowers that I cut out rather than like a whole sheet. And yeah, just sort of pinning them. And I guess because when I was sort of doing it in my studio, I didn't really have a light shining directly on it, so you don't really notice the shadows. And then until you hang it on the wall, then it's like, oh, that's a shadow. Oh. But I don't consciously make the pieces to with a shadow in mind. The shadow is always sort of incidental bonus to the piece.
It sure is. It's so cool, because then you instantly see that depth too. I just wrote about someone the other day. I can't remember now, but in their materials list, shadow was one of the things.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't really say it was. It's not something I particularly consciously plan when I make a piece, but it's always interesting how it comes out once the piece is kind of.
Yeah, it is. It's a beautiful, happy accident. I love it.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously when, and it's really nice when you know, if it's the piece gets sort of light through the day on it, because then you get different shadows coming, you know, as the light passes over the piece, so it's all, you kind of get a sense of movement.
Yeah,
which is really nice.
Oh, love it. Okay, here's a question. So you're cutting paper with your Japanese knife.
Yes.
Then you do metal pieces.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, I guess it came about, I mean, I can't remember exactly what happens. I managed to get myself an RSI injury in my cutting hand.
Oh.
Which actually didn't, at the time I didn't stop. I mean, I went through various consultants, and they decided it was like a sort of inflamed tendons, basically. And the consultant said, I'm not naive enough to know that if I tell you to stop, you're going to stop. So no, I'm not. But I guess that kind of brought up some thoughts about maybe, you know, I need to find something else to do, you know, or I need to have other things that I can do, because obviously, you know, it doesn't hurt at all now when I'm cutting, but sometimes, like, if I do lift really heavy things for, you know, or carry things, I do, you know, it does can hurt sometimes. But I guess it's like, and you know, there's also kind of issues with necks and shoulders, and I mean, all artists suffer those kind of things. It's like, as you get older, things start hurting that don't hurt when and I guess it kind of it sort of came, I guess it came out of a few years of me trying to figure out another way of making some things that were similar to what I was making in paper, but also different. And also something that I could do as installations that could maybe be more permanent than the paper. Because the problem is, you know, I mean, the paper's fine behind frames and in someone's house, you could do an installation. But if you want to do like a hotel lobby or something, you know, somewhere that there's a lot of through traffic of people, paper, unless it's, you know, in some kind of box or frame, isn't really, it's not sturdy enough and stable enough to have a longevity. So I made some pieces out of laser cut wood, which I quite like, but didn't quite kind of work how I wanted because they were a bit clunky. And it took me a long time to figure out how to cut metal, because most laser cutters don't cut metal because you need a different type of laser. Most laser cutters that cut paper and wood are CO2, and to cut metal you need a different and I just didn't know. I mean, I've seen other artists with doing these amazing metal kind of installations that were really fine, and I just didn't know how do you do that. And I can't remember, there's an artist, I can't remember his name, who made this amazing field of, and they were all these little tiny flowers, and they were colored on one side and black on the other.
Oh yes, I've written about him. I'll put it in the post because I can't remember his name either, but that was stunning.
Is this Zabok Ben David? Someone like that, something. So I saw that piece in an exhibition in London, and I think I was just one afternoon just sort of Googling around, and I think I found on his website something about acid etched, and I'm like, okay, what is that? And so I was kind of googling, and then I realized that's how you cut metal, is through acid etching, because it's basically how it's a printmaking process, but you can obviously cut through the metal rather than just etch into it. So once I kind of discovered that, then it's like an opportunity to make very fine things out of, you know, cut, because you can cut metal. I mean, mostly the metal I use is like 0.3 or 4 millimeters in depth, so really tiny.
Yeah, they're
thin metal, so you know, so you can get that sort of elegance and that fineness that I couldn't really get in the wood.
Yeah, when you said that about the wood, I instantly was picturing sort of clunkier, because your paperwork is so delicate, and you'd want to replicate that, and the metal does it perfectly. Like, I remember when you emailed me that and said, "Oh, I've been doing some new stuff." I was like, what? And I thought the same thing that you thought, like, how did she do that? And so can you do that in your studio? Like, is it an acid bath or what?
Me acid baths. No, I do a digital drawing, and then I send it off to a company, and then they send me back a piece of metal.
Okay, because yes, I would be afraid for you.
That's really, I'd be afraid. Yeah, just going to my acid bath. Yeah.
If I don't come out, don't worry. Oh my goodness.
I've got less fingers. Don't worry about it.
And so are you still doing those metal ones?
I am, yes. I sort of made them. I'm still working on, I'm actually working on a whole bunch of new birds and sort of things. I kind of made a lot, and then sort of, I guess it's still one of those things that you kind of, I'm still figuring out exactly how I want it to go.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something I'm still, working on.
Yeah. Like, paper is your first love.
Paper. I mean, I guess I've always worked on paper more. I mean, I did have a phase of doing canvas painting on canvas, but in the end, I'd end up sticking paper all over the canvas. So.
We do. I can't not collage. Like, I just physically can't cut something out, like not cut something out. Before we stop talking about metal, what is it? Is it copper or brass or what is it?
Most of them, like the birds and things, are made of brass. And then the monkeys and the sort of smaller ones are actually stainless steel that then I gilded with Dutch gold leaf.
Oh my God.
The problem with metal is it's really difficult. You can't really paint it. And I also wanted to have some of these things that are kind of painted. Well, you can paint it, but it's quite tricky because obviously metal is very smooth. And but you need to put some sort of surface. You need to get some grip on the surface with the paint or with the gold leaf. It's, it's something I'm still kind of wanting to resolve, because I'd kind of like to have something that's that sort of fine that I could maybe paint on top or do something like around it or something. I'm not quite sure, but yeah, most of them are brass, because I kind of like I like the color of brass, and the fact that it, and it changes when, if it's over time, it kind of gets a really nice patina.
Mm-hmm. And so, do you find that? So, you had another good segue for me there earlier when you talked about installations. So, are you still doing lots of installations these days? And if you do, do you do them in metal generally?
I haven't done many big metal installations, though. I have one coming up this year, in the beginning of the year, that I'm doing in someone's house. It's something I want to do more of with the metal, and I guess it's one of those things that I need to do some to get good photographs to show people. Right. It's always that difficult thing that if you don't have a photo of it, a thing installed, it's quite hard for people to imagine how it might fit in their house. And it's so fingers crossed for a commission at the minute that hopefully will come off as well. That would be a big metal installation in someone's house in America. So
that's cool.
We're keeping our fingers crossed that they go for it.
Yeah. Oh, keep me posted on that. That's exciting.
Yeah. So it's definitely, I'd like to do some more metal ones. And I think it's just, I need to kind of get a bit more engaged in doing some. One of the commissions I'm doing is in a friend's place, so which will be quite good because the husband's a photographer. So that's what I'm lined up.
Perfect.
To do some good photographs of it, and you know, I think it's always difficult when you're trying to do installations. It's like, because you need to install the thing somewhere so that people can see it installed, so that they can know they might want it installed in their place.
Yeah,
and it's like a sort of chicken and the egg thing. So it's kind of trying to find opportunities where, you know, you can find a space to install it, get good photographs, and then, you know, persuade people that that would look amazing in the house.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too hard to persuade them, I'm sure. Are you doing like exhibitions at all this year? Or are you concentrating more on commissions like that?
I haven't got anything lined up until later on in the year. I've got some work in the Bedford Gallery in which is in the Bay Area.
Oh, really?
They've got a big paper exhibition. Well, no, it's not paper. It's called Cut Up, Cut
Yes,
Out. It's
yes.
an exhibition about artists that cut out things.
Yeah. I did. I curated a show there. Aren't they the nicest people in the world?
Yes. Yeah, really lovely. So I've got work in there. And then I think that's going to be touring to other places in the States. I think it's going to somewhere in Virginia, but I'm not quite sure when. So that's there till March.
Okay. That is such a beautiful gallery, and that sounds like such a great show. I saw that that was up right now, but I didn't realize you were in that. That's so cool. What was I going to ask you? So, okay, my final thing before we do the not so speedy speed round. What is next for you? Well, we kind of covered that. You've got these things coming up. What do you wish was next for you? Like, what would you love to be happening?
I've kind of embarking on a whole new bunch of work kind of post the political happenings last year, which somehow felt very affecting. I mean, you know, with stuff here and stuff in America and Syria and I don't know, it just, something happened that just made me feel like I had to make some work that I could express my kind of feelings about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of, I've been sort of for a month now, working on it still. I'm kind of nurturing my new little kind of, I don't really want to say the word baby because it's not like having a baby, but kind of, they're like little seeds.
Yeah.
They're growing.
Yeah.
The shoots are coming up, and I'm kind of getting to the point where hopefully in the next month or so I'll be able to start showing the world what I've been up to, because I'm very excited about it. It's going to be quite different. It's probably not going to be made out of paper. I feel like it's like I've been doing the paperwork for 14-15 years, and it's like I love it, but it's maybe I need to do something else as well. And I don't know, I like making the meds work and I'm not going to stop that, but it's like, even that's not quite, you know, I've been looking for the thing that's going to, there's like an itch that I've been trying to scratch for a few years now, and that's where the metal came in and various other things, and nothing's quite got there, but I think what I'm doing now might be the thing that might get there.
Ooh, I love that. Yep, don't retire at IBM. Keep moving.
Exactly. And, you know, I think as an artist, you kind of have to, I don't know, it was just all, it was such an emotional year last year, kind of politically, you know, and like some big, you know, like people like David Bowie and Prince, who were kind of, you know, part of my teenage years. All those, you know, people like that dying, George Michael, and, you know, dying. And then, you know, it's like this, it's like the world is just, there's some fracturing going on. And I don't know, other artists that I've, you know, communicate with via social media mostly, but I think people are feeling the same thing. It's like they need to find a way to express something about the world right now.
Absolutely.
And it's you know, I guess, you know, you're lucky as an artist that, you know, I want to be able to, it's like, I don't think one person can change, but if we're all out there putting stuff out there, it's like a collective.
Yeah, we're all saying this is not right, and this fracturing is crazy, and there's so many things. I know, I feel really overwhelmed by it too. I did a big Facebook post before the new year saying, you know, I mean, and it's weird being Canadian because, like, you know, the whole Brexit thing, like, you can't vote for that. The whole Trump thing, I can't vote for that. You know what I mean?
You know what? If you lived in the UK, you could have voted in the Brexit thing. Bizarrely, because you're people from Canada, India, if you're resident in the UK, you can vote in all our elections.
Really?
Actually, I don't know about Canada, but India, and if you're on part of the Commonwealth,
Canada, you can vote.
I think Canada probably can. If you were a resident in the UK, you as a Canadian could have voted in the Brexit.
Wow.
If you were European, none of the Europeans that might have been living here, you know, EU, other EU citizens, not British citizens, they couldn't vote. Even though they've been living, you know, I have many friends that are from, anyway, we don't want to get down the Brexit because it's very depressing.
No, and it's all very depressing.
It must be weird being Canadian and being attached to America.
It's really weird. And I, you know, the same thing, I feel like artists have an opportunity, you know, to express themselves and, you know, say what they want to say about all of this, and hopefully, you know, parts of the world get to see it, you know, depending on how big your reach is and stuff. And so I think it's a really amazing thing for artists to take this time and to do that. I love that you're doing that. And, you know, I can't help it, but it's snuck into my collages too. And sometimes it feels so overwhelming because you're like, well, what do I comment on? Like, there is so much right now to comment on.
Yeah, I guess it's just, there's so much fear and not enough love, and that's kind of what I want. That's ultimately what I think, you know, what I want to put out, is that we need more love, less fear. And if there's enough people doing that in whatever art form, you know, their chosen form is, then there will be, you know, an upswell of it. And I think we just, you know, it feels like a sort of duty, because, you know, it's almost like we've sleepwalked into this position we're in now, certainly here in the UK with the whole Brexit thing.
And US too, for sure.
Well, I mean, in the US, yes. And you know, it feels like we've, you know, and it's like, I feel, you know, it feels very sort of, you know, I live in London, it's a bubble, you know, my borough that I lived in, 72% of us voted to remain in the EU. So, you know, we're kind of, I don't engage with people that are different, you know. I visit people outside of London, but most of my family live in Scotland. They all voted to remain. So it's like, I don't have that knowledge of people that, you know, that are clearly hurting.
And
you know, it's like, you know, it feels kind of neglectful that you're not, you know, it's like trying to figure out how to engage with those people. Well, just in the world in general, I don't know, just, you know, that we all need to put something out there to kind of, to redress the balance.
Yeah, that was so well said. That gave me goosebumps.
Okay, good. So hopefully the work. It feels very. I feel more excited, I must admit, when I think about it. I'm smiling here. You can't see it that I have about anything in a long while, and you know, it feels like the time is bright. And you know, I'm 2 years away from being 50, and that feels like kind of whoa. I don't really know how to place that because I don't feel. 50 feels old and I don't feel old.
Yeah, I know. Well, 50's the new, let's say 50's the new 30. That sounds good to me.
I think so. But at the same time, I don't want to hide from that because I don't think you should pretend. I don't like the idea of saying I'm not the age I am. You know, it's like, why should I hide what I am? And I think maybe that's, you know, there is something in that. Getting older, there's a bit more of a kind of like, I don't care anymore. I'm just gonna do it, and that's that.
I know. I'm 43, and I have a friend who just turned 40 a couple of days ago, and she before her birthday, she's like, "Oh my gosh, 40!" And I said, "Just wait, it's awesome." You know, I said before I turned 40, people told me about the fuck at 40, and you just hit that age that you're like, you know what? I don't care. I'm not going to say yes to things I don't want to do. You know, I think especially probably for women, you know, it's just like, you know what?
Yeah.
I'm done. Like, I'm going to have the life that I want. And I think that's so funny. And that I've totally found that in my 40s already. And it's a privilege to grow older. You know, there's so many people that don't get to grow older. Like, I'm sure George Michael would have liked to keep going, you know? So,
well, he's 53, you know?
I know.
And it's like, geez, that isn't that far away.
No. Well, hopefully you have a different life than George.
Well, I mean, I haven't lived quite in the way George has.
No.
So, you know, yes. But, you know, you just think, I'm not done yet. And it's like, I think it is that thing of like suddenly, I mean, yeah, it's a fuck it 40s, fuck it 50s.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's just like, I've got to get... And there's work to be done and I've got to do it, you know, and you can't let go.
Yeah. Well, the world is bubbling like that right now. There's so many people who, like you said, like so many of us were just sleepwalking, assuming everything was okie dokie. And then all of a sudden it's like, what? And so I think so many people are bubbling up that were quiet before. And so it'll be very interesting to see, like in that Facebook post I wrote, I said, you know, this is when art movements happen. Around wars, around huge political change, like the artists in those times would flare up and say their thing. And, you know, it would create whole new art movements. And so I think that is the moment that we are at right now. I think 2017 is just going to be very interesting to see what happens in the world and in the art world. I'm so excited to see what you're up to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm looking forward to share. I'm kind of itching to share, but it's just not ready yet.
Yeah, no, then that, yeah, don't share yet then.
Yeah, so and I, you know, and I'll know when the time is right.
Yeah, and I'll be waiting. Okay, so that was super. That was about as political as Art for Your Ear has ever been, and I loved every single second of it. But now we're heading into the not so speedy speed round, which is ridiculous. So it'll be quite the balance. Okay. Well, I have to ask this: coffee or tea?
Well, tea.
Yeah.
but green tea. I don't drink kind of English breakfast tea type tea. Green tea.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. if you could live anywhere in the world, where would you pick?
Paris.
Oh.
30 miles away. So why am I not there?
I don't know. I love Paris too.
Oh, I love Paris. Yeah. Come over to, when are you going to come to visit London?
Well, I don't, you know what? There's a few things in the works. I wonder if I should mention them just to peer pressure. There's a big conference in London. I won't name it, but I would really love to come and be a keynote at it.
Oh,
and then if I can do that, that gets me to London. And then I would love to do, I know I've got lots of readers and listeners and stuff in Amsterdam and Paris.
Yeah.
And my parents used to live in Brussels. So I used to come over when I was in university. I'd come every summer and every Christmas. And so I got to do lots of traveling, but I haven't been back in years, like since right before my husband and I got engaged, like, oh my gosh, like 15 years or something. And so I would love to come start in London and then do like a little tour, you know, but I got to get myself there. So if I can't get myself an airline sponsor, which doesn't seem to be coming through, I need one event. Do you know what I mean? That will bring me, and then I can go and do my thing. But I just need that one key. So if anybody's listening and they want to fly me to Europe for any particular reason, I'm in.
All right. Well, we're putting it out there.
Okay. There we go.
Maybe we can crowdfund your ticket.
Yeah, there you go. Kickstarter. My little European adventure. I'll backpack, I swear. Okay. Were you ever in a high school play?
Actually, yes, I was. I think I played Bob Scratchit in the Christmas Carol.
Oh, so cute. That my son was in his first play ever, and that's what it was, Christmas Carol, Christmas. He was a charity guy that was asking Scrooge for money. Starting slow, working his way up to the big roles later.
Well, you know, you got to start somewhere.
Exactly. Okay, final one. When I wrote this, I was like, I don't know Claire at all. Like, I am going to have to play this one by ear. But now I feel like I could ask it. Would you rather hold a snake or a mouse?
A snake, actually.
Oh, my God. That just gave me, like, goosebumpies. No. Oh.
Mice are incontinent. I mean, mice are just, yeah. I mean, I'm not scared of mice, but they're just dirty. As a snake, they're kind of beautiful creatures. Yeah, I wouldn't mind a snake.
Claire, this might be the end of our friendship. Although, you could hold the snake and then I wouldn't have to. So then that might...
The snake would probably eat the mouse anyway. So,
yeah,
you know.
I know. As I was writing that, I was like, oh, poor little mouse. You know, we have snakes all over the place here and they freak me out.
I see. We don't have stuff like that. I mean, there are some snakes in the UK, but they're nothing that could bite you and do anything dangerous. And you rarely see them anyway. Right. And in the centre of London, no snakes.
Yeah, you're good. You're good. Yeah, there might be a few more mice roaming around London than snakes. Foxes.
Yeah, mice, foxes, squirrels, birds. That's our nature.
I lived in London for a summer.
Yeah.
In Elephant and Castle.
Oh, okay.
It was very interesting.
It's changed. It's changed a lot since you then. It's gone a bit upmarket now.
Oh, good. It was very scary when I lived there. That was like 20 years ago. And I lived and worked in a pub. And I worked in the pub and I lived upstairs and two Irish ladies owned it. And they basically said, yeah, I wouldn't go out after about 6 p.m.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we lived in a very... bad little corner and it was scary, but I had a great time. The Irish ladies were hilarious and I got really good at pouring Guinness by the end of that summer.
It's a good skill to have. It's important to do it the right way.
Yes, well, the little Irishman that would come gave me a very hard time if I couldn't draw the shamrock in the top of the foam.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Wow, you got real skills.
Oh yeah. So by the end of the summer, they loved me and I would do like a little heart or like a little D for Danielle. I tried to do a maple leaf, you know, to pass on my Canadiana, but there's too many points and I would overflow every time.
Yeah. It's kind of quite complicated.
Yeah. That was too much for me. Too much. Yeah. Even all my art school training did not help me there. So I had to go back to shamrocks, but that's okay.
Yeah. I guess the shamrock for a purpose, because it's not got many, there's not many leaves, is it?
Yes,
not many,
yeah. It was quick. A little whoop, 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 yeah. Done. Anyway. Oh, Claire, that's it. That's all my questions.
Wow. I was so excited. I woke up at 5:30 this morning, so excited about this.
That's hilarious. I'm so glad that we finally did it. And you're so lovely and smart and talented. And that was such cool conversation. And I hope lots of people get lots of things out of it, and especially to, you know, follow your lead and use your art to say the things you want to say about our world. I think that's so powerful, and I can't wait to see what you're making.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, we can only use the tools we've got, can't we? So whatever your art is, get out there. And I think it's important. Now just feels like the time.
Yeah, it does. It does.
It's important.
Okay. Well said. Well, if I manage to sneak myself to London somehow, you will be the first person I call, and
Definitely. I will take you out for a drink for sure.
Done. Sounds great. All right. Well, have a lovely rest of your evening, and I will talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. More love, less fear. Amen. Thanks to Claire for sharing her story. Thanks to Saatchi Art for supporting this episode. And of course, thank you so much for listening. There will be more art for your ear next weekend. See you then.